If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, August the 3rd, and you're listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a Hoover Research Fellow. My guests today in this recording studio, deep in the heart of Stanford University's campus, are David Brady and Douglas Rivers. Dave Brady is the Hoover Institution's Davies Family Senior Fellow, a Stanford University political scientist and watcher of elections. Doug Rivers, likewise, is a Hoover Senior Fellow and a Stanford political scientist. He is also the chief scientist at YouGov PLC, a global polling firm. And if you go to Doug's Twitter feed, he describes himself as, quote, an absent-minded professor, sometime entrepreneur, pollster, and econometrician. And would it be fun to set up a Twitter account for Dave Brady and write up his description?
I don't want one.
A little grumpy. Yeah.
A lot grumpy. Gentlemen, the election right now is 94 days away. This past week, in non-Trump-related news, the planet Mars came within 35.8 million miles of planet Earth, the closest it'll get until the year 2287. I feel like we're no closer to making sense of this election.
Fake news.
Fake news. But I brought you two in the studio today to help me make sense of this election. So we're within 100 days right now. Is this election baked?
No, not at all. So there's a range of polling on the congressional elections. The average in the Real Clear Politics average for the generic congressional ballot, which is just asking people which party they're going to vote for, mm-hmm. has the Democrats at +7. In the latest YouGov Economist poll, we're at +4, which is kind of the low end of the range. Other people are at +10. We think at +6, this is basically a toss-up for control of the House. Mm-hmm. Whereas +4 would mean Republicans could probably retain control of the House. The nature of midterm elections is as the margin goes up, you tend to pick up a lot of seats. +10 might not be a huge wave, but it certainly would be much closer into the wave territory where the Democrats could have a comfortable majority in the House.
Right.
That all sounds great, but it does seem to place a tremendous amount of faith in one question and two things. One, the gets better the closer you get to the election, and it's so highly correlated with a lot of other things, and turnout. So it seems to me, and
So in 2/3 of the seats, we now know who the candidates are, and we're actually polling with the candidate names. When we do that, we're at a Democrats +6 in that polling, which is based on a larger sample. But there's still a third of the races where the candidates are not yet determined.
So, just to press this point, the main variable that you that's hardest to predict is turnout, and the generic ballot, as you get close to the election, it's more relevant, but. At this point, the turnout is hard to figure out. So the question is, suppose it's women, where Trump does have his biggest gaps. If Democratic women, independent women who don't like Trump, and are independent women, about 15-20% negative on his approval rating. So if they turn out, then it's good for the Democrats. But Doug and I have been looking at this for some time, and you've been talking about it with the Tom Steyer thing in the Post. Maybe if we went there, that'd be good.
We'll get to Mr. Steyer in a minute. So, gents, I went back and I looked up YouGov Economist generic ballot numbers going back beginning of the year. Early January, the first Economist YouGov measure of the generic ballot, you had the Democrats up by 6. So it continued into February, March, and April it peaked at 7. In May, it dropped down to 3. June, it picks back up to 6. July, it goes down to 4. In August, right now, going into August, you have it at 4 as well. But here's an interesting contrast. At the same time that you have kind of a fluid election, it doesn't show a runaway. for one party, you look at the numbers in the House, Dave and Doug, and here's what you see. Last week we hit a milestone, by the way. All 50 states have now reached their deadlines for candidates filing to run for a federal office in November. So now we know, you know, how things are set up. You'll find there are 39 House Republicans and 18 Democrats not seeking re-election. Now, the various definitions of not running for re-election, 13 Republicans, 10 Democrats are running for another office. But there are a total 42 open House Republican seats right now, retirements and vacancies right now. In terms of pure retirements, 26 Republicans are stepping away from politics altogether, as are 8 Democrats. That is the most Republicans retiring since 2008, and it's the fewest Democrats retiring since, not a coincidence, 2008. So here's the question, gentlemen. While you don't necessarily see trouble at the moment, according to the YouGov economist numbers for Republicans, if it's a 4-point spread, as you just mentioned, my goodness, there are a lot of House Republicans abandoning ship.
Yeah, this is not going to be a good Republican year. Mm-hmm. If they hold on, it will be just barely. The retirements you're seeing are people, in many cases, don't look the looks of the electoral landscape.
Right.
Having said that, however, one thing that we've seen over the last 10 years is a decrease in the incumbency advantage in House elections. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, an incumbent running for re-election after their initial election to Congress could expect a 6 to 7 point bump. And that's looking like it's down into the 1 to 2 point range. So the open seats don't make as much a difference as they used to.
No, I agree with that. It's one of the things you want to have to predict off your election results is you want to know among Democrats and Republicans what the margin is, how many of them will vote for a Democratic Republican. And Doug's absolutely right. The personal vote, the ability of a Republican to get Democrat votes or vice versa, that's way down. It's down 1.5. Split ticket voting is way down, so it's easier to predict now.
One of the inventors of a measure called sophomore surge is in the room with us.
Yes.
And that's the increase in vote that a incumbent gets in their first run for re-election. Mm-hmm. And it was discovered by someone who was old enough to be doing research in that era.
He's talking about me, of course.
That this more or less arose in the early 1960s,
right,
and was a key component of the American political landscape for up until the 1990s.
Okay.
And that's quite a transformation we're seeing.
All right. So to the question of where is Waldo, where is Donald Trump these days? Donald Trump this past week campaigned in Florida in the gubernatorial contest, and he campaigned in Pennsylvania for the Republican running for the Senate there. On Tuesday, he is going to Ohio, which is the scene of a special election. Ohio's 12th congressional district has a special election. Boy, this is just gluttony. They're going to have a special election in August and run it again in November. So
it's good for the polling business.
It's very good for the polling and also local TV, I would add, too. Do well in ads. But here we have kind of replay of what happened in Pennsylvania in May. A fellow named Connor Lamb runs as the Democrat, and Connor Lamb does his best to A, try to fit in the district, and B, run away from Nancy Pelosi. The Democrat in this race in Ohio is a fellow named Danny O'Connor. He's a 31-year-old county recorder, so he's a political newbie, and he does not want to be linked at the hip to Nancy Pelosi, which seems to be the Republican strategy here. So, a couple questions coming out of this election. You guys are looking at the polls. You're looking at what's moving voters right now. You have a lot of confusion on the Democratic side as to what messaging should be. And this gets into Tom Steyer. You have Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who seem to think that we need to talk about socialism. We have Democrats who think we need to talk about health care. We have Democrats like Tom Steyer, the hedge fund billionaire here in San Francisco, who want to talk impeachment. You have Republicans who want to talk the economy. You have Republicans who want to talk fake media. Republicans who want to talk immigration. Help me make sense of what messages are moving voters in this election.
You also have Republicans like Steve Bannon who want to talk impeachment because they think that mobilizes the Republican base.
Okay, let's start with impeachment then. So The Washington Post runs an article today on Friday with Tom Steyer, an interview with him, and Mr. Steyer is lamenting his frustration with his fellow Democrats, and he is upset.
It's a mistake.
He's upset by the fact that he has been running a effort called Need to Impeach. He's collected 5.5 million signatures. He claims there's energy out there for this, and yet 49 people who caucus with the Democrats in the Senate. Steyer says not a one wants to do impeachment.
He claims that increased turnout.
Steyer, Doug, is marching around with polling data, and he claims that that impeachment bumps Democrats. It encourages them and it inspires them, and it'll get them to turn out in larger numbers. The pushback is you do impeachment, it's going to ricochet against you. It's going to turn off independents. Tell me what your polling suggests.
Exactly what you said. Yes, you can excite the Democratic base, particularly in Brooklyn and San Francisco, with talk of impeachment. Mm-hmm. Those are not places where the Democrats need to pick up seats.
Right.
And, you know, it's fine to have a socialist candidate in Brooklyn. It's not in, rural Pennsylvania or Ohio. That voted for Donald Trump. The remarkable thing that we've seen, though, is 10-plus point swings from the 2016 election in the specials. And those are people where the Democratic candidate has been successful by running away from Nancy Pelosi. Most people don't really care that much about the minority leader of the House, that was a Freudian slip. It is a way for moderate Democratic candidates to signal that you're voting for somebody who's not going to be hard left.
Right.
And, that's just good politics. You got to win the marginal seats.
The big issue, though, is what you earlier brought up, all those different themes in the wave election. 94, Anti-Clinton, 2006, Bush mm-hmm. and the war, 2010, Obama and health care and so on. You don't have that profusion of issues. Mm-hmm. None of those have caught on in the sense that it's going to be a wave election across the board, sort of to one party. Now, that could still happen, because most people don't really start to pay a lot of attention to this till after Labor Day and the kids are back in school. And mm-hmm. But at this point, it seems to me this is an indication that this election is 50. I would not be surprised if the Republicans held the House narrowly. Democrats will pick up seats. Question is how many. And I think the profusion of issues is just another little proof, bit of evidence that this is not, at this point, a wave election. Doug, you agree?
Yeah, though I think 100 days is a long time in politics.
No, I agree. I agree with that. Something could happen. But the point is, it's not out there now, and none of us around here could say, I think it'll be this with any assurance that it would be.
Yeah, I think what we have seen is that Republican enthusiasm for voting has gone up over time. It looked in the spring like it was the most depressing thing you could think about for Republicans. The Democratic base was fired up over gun control. They hate Trump. The Republican, Trump has his base, but it's a third of the electorate.
Right.
And the rest of the people who Republicans might get votes from weren't really very interested in politics at that point.
Right.
And what you're going to see as you get towards the election, the choice is going to become clearer to people. And we'll see whether the normal sort of Republican advantage in midterm turnout holds up.
Let's talk Trump for a second. So I went back and I crunched the numbers, the Economist, YouGov, job approval numbers on the president going back to the beginning of the year. The first poll in January 2018, Dave and Doug, Trump has a 43% positive, a 54% negative. We fast forward now to August, and he is at 43% positive, 53% negative. Despite all the craziness of Sturm und Drang, the ups and downs of the first 8 months of this year, Donald Trump's numbers have changed all of 1 point. He is 1 point less negative than he was in January, and his popularity holds the same.
It just doesn't seem to move. There's good news, there's bad news. The economy is ticking along pretty well.
Right.
A normal president in these circumstances would be declaring it's morning in America,
right.
And Trump is saying it's carnage.
Right.
But it doesn't seem to have any effect. He'll go from, what I think was generally agreed to be a disastrous performance in Helsinki. Mm-hmm. We saw barely a move following that. You get some great economic numbers. You don't see much movement following that either.
No, you look at these numbers, he has moved, his highest has been 45%, and his lowest in terms of his negatives has been 51%. So every poll is the same margin of error poll each time, so he just doesn't budge.
I'd like to go back just a little bit to something Doug said. He said, will the Republican advantage and turnout hold up? And I have in front of me the numbers since 1990, and in every election since 1990, every midterm election, mm-hmm. Republican turnout has been better. Right. Strong Republicans turn out more than strong Democrats, and so on across the board. Mm-hmm. However, the second part of that is how many Republicans are there relative to how many Democrats.
Right.
And Democrats look like they have about a 4 or 5 point advantage. So those two work it out. And independents then play a really important role in determining these election results. They did in every wave election, 94. In 2010, for example, mm-hmm. they voted 60% for Republicans, and in 2006, 62% for Democrats. So what do you have independents doing, both in terms of turnout and...
Yeah, so independents typically have lower turnout because right. to some degree being independent is a sign of... less interest in politics, not taking a position. If you look at Trump approval, we have independents at 41 approve, 51 disapprove, which is, you know, okay news for the Democrats.
But if you add women, if you look at independent women,
yes.
that adds another 6 or 8 points.
Yeah, that one's a little tricky because right. when we talk about independents, we're typically throwing in leaners, not pure independents. Mm-hmm. And so within independents, there are people who lean towards the Democrats or the Republicans.
Yeah, I was talking about
that frequently look very partisan. And the women in those tend to be yeah. Democratic women.
I was speaking of pure, well, same now, pure independents, independent women. Independent men are more pro-Trump by quite a bit than right. independent women.
Yeah. I don't have that number in front of me, but the problem...
Will they turn out?
All right, so the big change that we've seen in 2016 that has even been exacerbated is the gender gap and the education gap. That is that women vote Democratic at higher rates than they have in the past, and college graduates vote at much higher rates Democratic than they did in the past
right.
among whites. And since 2016, that appears to have just expanded. So the places where Democrats are making the biggest gains are these suburban areas where in the past you had affluent people who were swing voters, and they're moving Democratic.
Right.
And the Republicans have compensated by picking up rural, ex-urban places that are more working class.
Right, very good. So you're suggesting, gentlemen, that independents went with Republicans in 2006, flipped the House, excuse me, Democrats in 2006 flipped the House in a big way
yeah.
to the Democrats. You're suggesting independents would have gone to Republicans in 2010 and flipped the House.
That includes
to the GOP,
leaders.
Right,
yeah.
in a big way. And we may be on the verge of independents flipping the House back to the Democrats.
Right.
That's three flips in 7 election cycles. So
yeah.
what's going on with these people? What are they upset about?
Well, first, the amazing thing is how stable it's been.
Yes.
You know, we haven't had any real landslides one way or the other.
Right.
You get this marginal group in the middle flipping, you know, 5 points one way, and it moves an election from one side to the other.
Right.
In terms of the, you know, if you looked at 2010 and 2014, healthcare was an albatross for Democrats. It was unpopular.
Right.
The marginal voters were worried about it. And that has moved to the point where Democrats are actually using it in their advertising. And it's not really, you know, Trump is not out there talking about repealing Obamacare. He's talking about immigration and, you know, to some extent the economy, though he doesn't really focus on that. You know, so the issues have shifted since those.
No, Trump is very much campaigning in 2018 as he campaigned in 2016, as I imagine he'll campaign in 2020. So you look at his, essentially, you look at his events in Florida and Pennsylvania, and yeah, he's there on behalf of candidate, but man, he's running his reelection campaign is what he's doing, in swing states, no less.
Yeah, the thing is he's doing rallies with his base.
Right.
It's a complete base strategy. There's
yeah.
no reaching out trying to figure out how I can get swing voters in these places.
Right.
So it plays well on TV. He says incendiary things. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced that he's doing any favors for Republican candidates.
Right.
So
Joe Biden went around the country in 2010 and talked the economy. I figured the president's too polarizing at this point, so we'll send out good old Scranton, PA Joe. He'll talk about it.
Yep.
And he carried with him a whole briefcase full of numbers saying things are better off than they were 2 years ago. He lost 60-plus seats.
Yep.
Well, one thing is we should make clear here is that the political system post-1990 or dated 88, whatever, post-Reagan, it's a much different political system. So if you look from 1932 to 1990, define a wave election as one party loses 30 seats.
Mm-hmm.
There were six, one of which changed the majority party in Congress, 1946. Since 1990, there have been three wave elections, 94, 2006, and 2010, and all of them changed majorities in the House. And the reason for that is because post-Reagan, the gap, the Democrats in the political system from 1932 to 1990, the Democrats on average, whether you counted just Democrat, Independent, but 3 point, some with leaners, it didn't matter. Democrats had about an 18-point advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Post-1990, their advantage is about 5 points. So they have to pick up independents or Democratic turnout has to be lower. But the point is, it's a much more competitive system now, and so little swings in the vote can create big election results.
Mm-hmm.
More for Republicans than Democrats, because the point is always made: the Democrats they're concentrated more; they waste their votes. In 2012, Romney lost by 5 million votes, carried 226 congressional districts. Trump lost by 2.5 million, carried 230. That means, in my view, the Democrats can't swing as many votes because they have too many majority-minority districts, too much concentrated in the city. They waste a lot of votes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Right. Donald Trump. How do Democrats play Donald Trump right now?
So, one tack is you say you're going to impeach him, which will get your base fired up.
Right.
But I don't think most Americans want to sign up for 2 years of impeachment hearings.
Right.
The sane way is let Trump be Trump, and he creates huge amounts of uncertainty that I think are a problem for moderate Republicans and help Democrats in general.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. So here in California, at least, Democrats seem to have finally gotten something after several frustrating cycles. So the past few cycles, they have tried to nationalize House elections. They have tried to make it about Barack Obama and Democratic agenda in that presidency, and they failed to unseat Republicans.
Yeah, the problem there is a repeat of the 2016 election doesn't get the Democrats the House.
Right.
They lost the majority of the House districts in 2016. They lost the electoral vote. They won the popular vote, but largely by winning running up huge margins in places like California, which are wasted votes.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you see in California, at least, Democrats have done a much better job of finding candidates who are just more specifically tailored to their districts, and they're staying away. Some of these fellows are staying away from Trump. They're trying to talk local frustrations. They're talking taxes. They're talking health care. They're staying away from the personality.
Well, you know more about that than either one of us. What's your view? And my view is, and I think the standard view was, if the Democrats don't take 4 or 5 seats in California, it's going to be hard for them to get the 24 seats they need.
I think they can pick up 4 seats in California. You just look at the June results and you look at turnout for Democrats, and it's strong. You look at some anecdotal things, for example, just rallies. You have large Democratic rallies going on in, say, Dana Rohrabacher's district, the 48th district, the Beach District in Southern California. They seem to have energy on their side. And for the most part, these candidates, it's an interesting contrast. You have, on the one hand, you have incumbent Democrats such as Eric Swalwell up here in California, who cannot be just more viciously anti-Trump in their rhetoric. The candidates, though, are avoiding Trump, for the most part, staying in issues. Why? I think in part because they don't want to in some way enrage the Republican base. There is something to be said. I'd be curious if there's any kind of polling evidence to back this up, though. But if you talk impeachment, if you go after the president in very personal terms, if it rallies Republicans to their president. Complicated as Donald Trump is, the fact is he is still a Republican president.
Definitely Steve Bannon believes that.
Right.
And they're, you know, launching an ad campaign, which they could do in combination with Tom Steyer, to raise impeachment as an issue. Because for Republicans, impeachment is trying to invalidate the legitimate election of 2016.
Yeah, you got to remember that plays out very differently across the different congressional districts.
Right.
The people. You know, so Tom Steyer's probably right about the base in California and New York and Massachusetts, but in the flyover states, I don't think that plays very well.
Yeah. There are, this many days ago in the election, though, there are a handful of variables. Let's go through a few of them and kind of discuss what might have political potency. Number one is the idea of a government shutdown over the wall.
Yes.
Bad news.
You're laughing, Republicans or not.
Yeah, that'd be just bad for Republicans.
When you control the presidency in both houses of Congress, saying that you're going to shut down the government is not a great strategy.
Right. Is it as simple as if whoever brings up the idea is the one who usually gets blamed for bringing it up?
Yeah, I remember Newt Gingrich, they shut it down twice, and the interview here at Hoover where I was interviewing.
But that was at least divided government.
Yeah, I know, but that's my point. He said, I said, well, you know, I kind of guess why you did it the first time, because, you know, you thought you might. He said, but the data were perfectly clear. They blamed, and I said, so why'd you do it a second time? He said, it was stupid.
Right.
If you got control of the government, it's really dumb to shut it down.
The first time he did it was because he thought he had Bill Clinton under his thumb.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton would just knuckle.
Yeah.
So he guessed wrong. But
it didn't work. Yeah.
Okay, so we're saying toxic idea.
Yeah.
This day and age.
Absolutely.
Okay. Number two, Brett Kavanaugh. Not really a House question so much as a Senate question.
Right.
I think what's happening on that is the Democratic the Republican strategy, Mitch McConnell's strategy is to, why have the vote now? Because they have three Democrats, Heitkamp, Donnelly, and Manchin, who voted for the first Republican Supreme Court nominee, and they want to put pressure on them, and they think they'll get a couple of those votes, so they could lose Collins and Murkowski from Alaska and Maine. And the Democratic strategy at this point is pretty smart in the same way. They want to bring up every paper they can. The guy's been around. They want to read a million papers, because what they'd like to do is postpone the vote till after the election, so that those three Democratic candidates would be free of it. I think on that one, McConnell will win, and they'll schedule a vote, and they'll pick up a couple of Democratic votes.
Though Jeff Flake is on vacation, which is causing them some problems at the moment. They can't actually vote it out of committee.
Yeah. Is he going to stay in?
Presumably he will be back before the election.
So this is not one of those Wisconsin scenarios where I have to go track him down in Illinois or something like that and drag him.
I think he's in Africa. But
yeah.
Interesting thing about the Trump support is, even though he has, you know, around 90% support among Republicans, it's about two-thirds strong approval and one-third somewhat approve.
Right.
And the people in the somewhat approve category are traditional Republicans who find Trump makes them a little uneasy. And the way they get reassured is by tax policy, by Supreme Court nominations like Brett Kavanaugh or Neil Gorsuch.
Yeah.
And so this is very helpful in terms of it's an uncontroversial issue among Republicans.
I agree with that.
Okay.
The Democratic base in, you know, California, New York, and so forth is looking at this as a vote on Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
The vulnerable Democratic senators are in places where they really don't want to cast a vote on that.
And I can tell you one thing in the hearing. When it occurs, I guarantee you that you will hear from Judge Kavanaugh stare decisis like 6 million times.
Exactly.
Because that's the way, that's his way out of commenting on the.
I think you're going to hear a lot about balls and strikes.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. You know who be the, you know who might be the savviest Democrat these days, Dave?
Pardon?
It's your friend Willie Brown.
Yeah. He's...
Willie Brown, to those who are listening, who are not in California, was the Speaker of the California State Assembly for 14 years, was in Sacramento for 30 years from 1964 to 1994, the so-called Ayatollah of the Assembly, then became mayor of San Francisco in the early 2000s. I say he's your friend because you you attend his lunches every now and then up in San Francisco.
Yep.
Willie writes a column for the San Francisco Chronicle and says, this says something about the times we live in, and that the sort of the clearest Democratic thinking you'll find is in the San Francisco Chronicle. Willie writes a column on Sunday, and what he said about Kavanaugh was simply this. When he was in the Assembly, he had a rule that if his Democratic Assemblymen had to vote against him on an issue because it was going to save their skin come November, go ahead and break with me because I want to have your votes next year. And that's his advice on Kavanaugh, that, look, if you got to vote for Kavanaugh to save your skin, better to save your skin and be back next year than to vote against Kavanaugh,
no,
get kicked
exactly.
out of office, and have Republican senators for the immediate future.
Yeah. Kavanaugh, absent some big scandal, which I think is unlikely, is going to get confirmed.
Right.
So the votes against them are wasted votes. And the problem with the Democrats is they desperately need the control of the Senate for the next nomination.
Right, and that's really kind of the hill that you want to die on, because the Kavanaugh nomination does not change the composition of the court in terms of conservative. It makes it more right and center. But it's if Ruth Bader Ginsburg leaves the Supreme Court next, now you're seriously changing the composition of the court. And if I'm a Democrat and I really want to play the abortion card and other progressive issues, that's the one you have to fight over, not Kavanaugh.
I might note that we have not talked about Senate elections at all.
Well, should we? Is there any? Is there really anything to say? I mean, is the Senate?
I think it's going to be hard for the Democrats to show if it's not a wave election, they won't take.
Okay, so
they
you
won't take the
so
House,
you give them Senate. You give them Nevada and Arizona, in a good Democratic scenario. So they pick up two seats there.
I wouldn't give them Arizona.
You wouldn't? Okay, so
no, well, they're definitely leading in Arizona.
Yeah, but, I'm but it depends on who gets the nomination.
In a positive
Arizona.
Democratic scenario, let's give them those two seats.
Okay.
Now two questions from there. How many of the red states can they defend? Because it's not just the really culturally tough ones.
I think they lose Missouri this time.
Okay,
she's
not going
to be as lucky as she has been in the past. Mm-hmm. I say that not just because the opponent is a Stanford graduate. I think Donnelly is likely to lose.
It's Indiana.
Mm-hmm. And now Tennessee is, I think, up again for grabs. I think the Democrat has a chance in Tennessee.
Right.
But in Florida, I think the Democrats have a chance of losing that seat.
Good chance of losing that seat.
So,
yeah, that's the extent you can spend tens of millions of dollars to have a sleeper race. That's kind of the one, because there you have Bill Nelson, who's, I understand his numbers are not that strong, in part because
we have him down by 4 points.
Doesn't have very big footprints in the state for some reason.
Yeah, he's not a great candidate.
Right.
And Rick Scott, the Republican governor running, another self-funder, high profile. Yeah, so the Democrats, to win control of the Senate, have to, they're probably going to lose Indiana. I agree with Dave on that.
Right.
That one looks increasingly hopeless. Mm-hmm. They then, assuming they win Nevada and Arizona, they need to hold Florida, West Virginia, Montana, and they could lose Missouri in that.
North Dakota.
North Dakota. Montana,
I think that Tester will win, and Tester will win in Montana.
Right. Looks like Tester's okay in Montana. It looks like Manchin's probably going to carry West Virginia.
I think he'll
West
get
Virginia.
By, too. But I think they'll lose Indiana, and I think they'll lose Missouri.
What about North Dakota, Heidi Heitkamp?
Again, that one's right on the edge. So there are more ways for Republicans to hold this than for Democrats.
The North Dakota one is really interesting because the Koch brothers withdrew support from the Republican candidate, because he's been talking pro-Trump on trade issues.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I saw, anyway, the most interesting comment I thought is this may be determined by soybean prices on election day.
Right, so this is Americans for Prosperity. This is interesting because they would typically pump a lot of money into a state like North Dakota, and by doing so would help out Mitch McConnell very much, because that's money McConnell could then cycle into, say, defending in Arizona or some other state to try to pick up. So,
So the likely outcome, I think, is that Republicans sort of stay about where they are. They lose a few and they pick up
a few. It could go 51-49, I'd say, would be my best.
They could pick up as many as two or three, and they could lose as many as, I think three is about the max they could lose.
Okay. I want to run two more topics by you in the time we have left. One is the Mueller investigation, which may or may not reach, I don't want to say conclusion, but some sort of fork in the road between now and the election in terms of a report or some sort of clarity of where it's going.
If he's going to issue a report, he really needs to do it this month.
Yes.
So if it doesn't happen,
so you're talking October surprise. Yeah.
Well, they definitely are going to hold it if it's.
Right.
You know, I suppose they could release something in September, but it's getting kind of close, and and I don't. You certainly, they don't leak much, so it's hard to tell what they're doing.
Right.
But you don't hear much rumblings of they're getting close to releasing a report.
Yeah, they're not going to release it. I think that there's, I don't think there's, collusion is hard to prove. I think the reason it's not going to be released is because what they're after now are all the money connections, and those are very hard to trace. And my belief is that's what they're doing now. They're tracing those Russian money connections.
So I think it's probably doesn't have that big an effect then. No report. Trump will say it's a witch hunt. Democrats will say it's treason, and the people.
Well,
the
Republicans in the House and Senate say you can't fire Mueller. So
where does
the worst thing would be if you fired him.
Where does Russia show up in your polling? Do people think in terms of
nowhere.
People thinking it had an effect in 2016? In terms of being on people's minds now? In terms of the present? Is it any kind of factor right now?
Well, it's another one of these very partisan issues that Democrats. By 90 to 10, I think Republicans interfered in the election, and Republicans by 60 to 35, roughly, think they didn't.
So if you ask the question, did they affect the election?
Right.
As did they? Then you get more Republicans saying, then the partisan gap goes even bigger. Independents don't care that much.
Yeah, I mean, Trump is playing this one very badly. That's the thing that has everyone puzzled. It would be very easy for him to say, you know, I'm telling Putin to keep his hands off of American politics.
Right.
I won the election fair and square, and we will not allow Russian interference.
But
he retreats to the view, you know, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, there was no interference, and then on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
He supports the
I support my intelligence agencies. Yeah. Though, of course, there were a lot of people who could have done it. You know, he never comes out with the full-throated, they tried, and we're not going to allow this. Running against the Russians seems to be such a no-brainer, and he's unwilling to do it.
It's what you saw beginning of the week with Rudy Giuliani, who made a comment about collusion not being a crime, then had to go on TV two more times the same day to try to explain what he was saying. And you're right, this White House is forever taking bites out of the same apple trying to explain this sort of thing. Let me run one more issue by you fellows, the National Football League. I was flipping around the channels the other night and stumbled upon an NFL game. This is the Hall of Fame exhibition game. There's nothing more jarring than seeing professional football being played, American professional football, not Canada, but U.S. NFL football going on in August. This is baseball season, not football season, but they're playing.
It's un-American.
I'm mentioning the NFL for this reason. Donald Trump is flat in the middle of the NFL. There will be, seven, 8 weekends of NFL football, at least between the opening of the season and the election.
Yeah.
That means 8 weekends where there's going to be discussions about the protest, 8 weekends for the presidents to tweet about this, 8 weekends to figure out what to make of this. I'm curious about the NFL. Maybe you should think about doing some polling on this, Doug, in this regard. Do people agree with Donald Trump's position on this? Do people agree with the players? Or is this a kind of issue that maybe just sort of deranges everybody? Because football at the end of the day is what? It's an escape. It's just 3 hours of watching football and getting away from politics, but now politics is landed smack dab in the middle of Sundays.
So we have polled on this.
Yeah, more agree with Trump.
Yes, and if Trump is defending the flag, the national anthem, that's something that he does better on than other things. So I think he does it because it's a relatively good issue.
But I don't see it as affecting congressional
elections. I don't think it moves tons of people because think you know, people want to watch sports and don't want to think about politics.
Right.
But both sides are injecting politics into this.
But if you're a candidate, I think it's pretty easy to get around, right?
Right.
But you probably wouldn't mention it, but if it comes up.
But is it the sort of thing that sours people on politics and the political? I'm kind of making a stretch here, but It makes you mad that we're having a friggin' political argument in the middle of a football game. Yeah. That puts voters in the bad mood. Voters go to the polls.
It increases
in bad moods.
The number of people who who don't believe in American institutions and don't like politics.
So if you're mad at the institution, you take it out on who controls the institution. So even if your poll shows that maybe people agree with the president on it, maybe in, again, this is roundabout thinking, but maybe in a roundabout way, they end up punishing Republicans because it makes them mad. Doug is about to tell me I'm nuts.
Yeah. I don't see that one. I don't think this is a great issue for the Democrats.
Right.
I don't think it's really a winning issue for Trump, but it's better than some other stuff he's got going. It's better than separating children from their parents. It's better from colluding with the Russians, or collusion is not a crime.
Well, but as we've seen, that has no effect on his numbers.
Yeah,
and the important thing is the Democratic swing is limited compared to the Republicans. The Republicans can go to 60. Democrats, I don't see under the best circumstances, Democrats. If it was a wave, the Democrats couldn't do better in 35 more seats.
No,
because they already control the seats they have, and the Republicans are solid in so many others.
No, once you start to get to a 10-point national margin, the seats votes curve starts to get steep.
Right.
So how big was it in 2010? I mean, 2006. It was around 10.
You start, for every additional point, you pick up, 2.5-3% more seats. Mm-hmm. So that people are miscalculating what happens when you get into double-digit leads. That's that's where you start. Districts that you thought were safe start to fall.
Right.
I don't think that's likely. And I think the Senate, that one's pretty baked.
Right. So I mentioned, Doug, that there are 42 open vacant House seats going to this election. 8 of those are in districts that Hillary Clinton carried in 2016. 13 of those are districts that Trump carried by less than 55%. So I suggest if there's a wave, those 21 are the first ones to get washed out.
Absolutely. I mean, we're seeing 10-point shifts in those elections. Those guys...
So Dave thinks 35 is the cap. So then the question is, can you find another 14? And then can you build beyond the 14?
Right. And to get above 35, you got to go into things that are currently considered safe.
Right.
So
an easier example is the Senate. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't think many people think the Democrats have much of a chance of winning the Texas Senate seat, the Cruz O'Rourke race.
Right.
But... if you're in double-digit national margins, that's a seat that actually gets contested. Seems to me highly unlikely, but that's what a wave looks like.
That's an interesting race because Ted Cruz certainly elicits strong feelings by both sides, but the fact of the matter there is political gravity, and the governor of Texas is running for re-election. The governor of Texas is going to get 65 or 70% of the vote in his re-election. Even if Ted Cruz is a wounded animal, he's still going to get dragged along across the finish line with that.
I do want to point out one thing about the 2006 election.
Mm-hmm.
Of the 30 seats the Democrats captured, 7 or 8 were from districts that were close in the previous election.
Right.
But 22 of them were from districts where the Republican had held a seat with 60% plus, mm-hmm. all the way up to 90%. So in those races, it's like Doug says, you get a bigger swing. But again, you have to factor in the candidates and the context of the individual race.
Yeah. So on the House side, the Democrats have pretty good set of candidates.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But, it is a different world. And getting to like a 70-seat swing seems to me we're not in that world any longer.
No, we're not. So final question, guys, and I'll let you go. You're advising the Democrats and Republicans on what to say on the stump. This is for House elections. And let's think about this in terms of the voters they need to pick up. So what's your advice to Republicans? What's your advice to President Trump, for example? Do you even send President Trump out on the stump, the school of thought? You lock him away and don't let him tweet. Just let the economy go along, let things cool off, let things take their course. What do you advise Republicans? But then also, what's your Democratic message as well? Because we seem to agree in this podcast, impeachment's not a winner, the government shutdown's not a winner, the NFL's not necessarily a winner. What messages do you guys propose in terms of actually building?
Varies candidate by candidate, say. Mm-hmm. In Indiana's 2nd District, where Mel Hall's running a pretty good race against the incumbent Republican woman, mm-hmm. he's I'm not going to vote for Pelosi, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the message in a kind of slog election rather than a wave, the message varies. And so you'd tell Democratic candidates to, in the Midwest, and run away from Pelosi, and the candidates on the Democrat candidates on the two coasts, what difference does it make? They're going to win. So, you know, that's like the turn out the base argument. That's great, but if that means NSU wins by three more points and they lose seats or continue not to get seats in Illinois and Iowa, that hurts them. The Republicans, I think, again, that varies. We had the Republican candidate for Senate in New Jersey out here, and that's a state where he has to not offend the Trump voters in New Jersey. But on the other hand, if he doesn't have independents, he has to get them. So, as you know,
it's a tailored message.
Yeah, he has a very tailored message.
Yeah, so for the Republicans, it's easy. If you could take away Trump's Twitter machine and get him to only talk about the economy.
But you can't.
Send
him to Africa looking for Jeff Flake is what you're suggesting.
Right. Democrats' problem is they don't really have a message here. They have not gotten the anything that appeals to the marginal working class white voters.
There's a reason for that, as you know.
Right.
It's a badly fragmented
so
party.
They do have what they call the better deal.
Yeah.
The better deal started on economics.
Right.
And then they recognize that maybe that's not the best suit in this election. So now the better deals understand it's tailored more toward the culture of Washington.
Yeah, that's a hard one to carry on a race by race.
Right.
I think the better deal messaging was fine. It's always tough to make the positive argument about the economy because there are plenty of people. Everyone that's doing well thinks they're doing well because they're working hard and they deserve it. And people who are doing badly think it's because the government's screwing them over. Mm-hmm. And so it's a fairly easy argument to say, you know, Trump has given big tax breaks to the rich and the corporations. Mm-hmm. And that would be the approach I would take to trying to get working class white voters thinking they're Democrats again. But they're not doing that effectively. And the culture wars are easier to explain.
I think they're not doing that effectively for a reason. So some of those blue-collar workers have received tax. They've gotten some money from the tax thing. And in the surveys I've seen where you ask workers who are affected by the tariff, they say they're willing to hang in. They don't see the Democratic Party, and I don't think the Democratic Party, after all this time, can put a message out like that's going to bring them around in the short term.
Well, I don't think they are capable of putting the message out, but there is a message that I think would work.
All right, so we're in the same
tariffs
the same
are a little
spot.
Too complicated. I would go against those as they're a tax increase on average working American.
But
that's worked in the past.
It's what Larry Kudlow, the White House economic advisor, it's what he says. It's a tax on working class Americans.
But the effects of those are it's hard to tell how much.
Got to go district by district.
Go district by district.
Yeah.
Right. In 2010, Obama tried to run on, we inherited a bad economy, it's better than it was.
Right.
The Republicans ran on, the economy's bad, and this healthcare thing, which is a lot of uncertainty, is bad for you. That worked amazingly well for Republicans. This year, I don't think Democrats can do well. The economy was rising under Obama, and Trump is just taking credit for something that was Obama. It's easier to take credit.
Okay, so let's wrap up here. It is Friday, August the 3rd, and Dave Brady has used the phrase slog instead of wave several times. So, Dave, you say at the moment, no wave, slog.
No wave, slog through, by which I mean it's district by district. I think I agree with Doug. It's like 50-50 at this point. About 100 days is a long time in politics.
Yeah, I think this one's probably going to break for the Democrats between now. And so I'm looking for probably a 30-seat gain. But right now, that's not where the data is.
Okay. Well, the good thing about Doug saying that is we can rub it in his face if he gets it wrong. But
yeah.
Let's
he's got time to recover. There's other podcasts.
Okay. Gentlemen, let's do this again before the election.
Okay.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Dave Brady and Doug Rivers and their colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover I-N-S-T. Doug Rivers is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Doug underscore Rivers. That's at Doug underscore Rivers. Dave Brady is not on Twitter, though we may set up an account for him after this podcast. YouGov. I mentioned the YouGov Economist poll. You can find YouGov at www.today.yougov.com. Anything else I need to plug, gentlemen?
Nope.
Nope. Sounds good. Thanks again for the conversation. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. For more podcasts and ideas from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org.